This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Dr. Carl Nelson. Today is September 4th, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Dr. Nelson is joining me in Chula Vista, California. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, telling me a little bit of biographical information. When and where you were born, what your parents' names were, what they did for a living, that type of thing?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Start with my grandmother on my Swedish side. She came to America in 1899, and had one son born in New York, and then and she was married there, but then sometime shortly divorced and moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And my father's name was Alfred Helgi Axel Nelson, and he was a first generation Swedish American.
Okay.
And my mother was Isabel Alice Nelson, younger rather, and Younger, younger. And she met my father when she was in her late, maybe 19 or 20, 21. And they fell in love, and they gave birth to me in 1930 on the 11th of October.
Okay.
And during the Deep Depression of that period, and 4 years later, they gave birth to my mother gave birth to a brother, Gordon Nelson.
Okay.
And essentially, we weathered the storm of the Depression in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
with I lived at one home, 2038 Dartmoor Street in Overbrook suburb of Pittsburgh, until I was 18 and I enlisted in the Navy.
Okay.
So I really had one home that I lived at.
Okay.
I was looking at your list here. My dad was a carpenter and an all-around handyman,
mm-hmm.
an excellent worker. But they separated when I was 12, and my dad went off and married and remarried sometime later after they divorced and moved to Cleveland. So I was without a dad from the time I was about 13 until I didn't make up to with my dad. With my dad and I didn't make up until later in life.
Okay.
But my childhood was a lot of work because my dad left and he didn't leave us any money. And so I worked a lot. I did paperboy things and set pins and did all those, worked in the gas stations. And graduated from Carrick High School, where I played varsity basketball and was active in school projects and somewhat,
mm-hmm.
and to the extent that my work allowed. And upon finishing high school, I went to work in downtown Pittsburgh for a company delivering as a delivery boy, and then I was going to night school at Allegheny High School and also at Carnegie Tech Night School. In the winter, I graduated in 1948 from high school. In the winter of 1949, very snowy, cold, and I found myself very bored and working and trying to go to night school.
Mm-hmm.
And then came April, March, I enlisted in the Navy and went to boot camp on April 9th, 1949.
Okay.
and went through boot camp and enjoyed that very much, and afterwards went to Class A Electronics or Electrical School.
Okay.
And while I was there in A school, I guess we call it, and we still do, I think, I was working out at the gymnasium when the coach of Great Lakes Navy basketball team found me and said, would you like to play for the base team? And not knowing much about the Navy, I said, you know, why not? So after A school, they kept me on, and I did tryouts and made the team. And I became a, I guess, a athletic person for the Navy, playing basketball for the Great Lakes Naval Training Station.
What position did you play?
I played in at high school. I played center because I was the tallest kid in the school.
Mm-hmm.
in the Navy, I played forward because they brought in a couple of guys who were taller than me.
Right.
And so I played forward on the basketball team.
Okay.
And then that winter, in February, I think it was, February, we flew, we were good enough to go and play in the All-Navy basketball tournament, so they flew us down to Opa-locka Naval Air Station in Florida.
Okay.
And played in the, and we, I don't remember, I think we came in second on the thing, but I'm not exactly sure. I think we lost to a Marine team from Hawaii. And then we came back from that, and my sports career in the Navy was over, and I was waiting for orders to my first sea duty when, and this is a true story, while I was in barracks, a telephone call came for me, and I picked it up, and I thought it was my mother because she was the only one that knew where I was, I think, essentially. And it was not. It was one of my best high school, actually grade school and high school friends, and still is. And he, his name is George Frazier, and he said, Carl, how would you like to go to Annapolis? And I said, well, I don't know much about it, but is it a good deal? And he said, I think it is. Why aren't you going to do it? He said, I'm at, where he was at Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, and he was in the Air Force ROTC, and he didn't want to be in the Navy. Or and so he said, if you want it, you can have a third alternate appointment, and you can try for the Naval Academy. And I agreed to that, and the Navy quickly changed my orders from whatever ship they were going to send me to Newport, Rhode Island, where they... we have a Naval Academy preparatory school.
Okay.
At the time. We still do have those have that school. I think it's still in Newport. And I was I got there in March, and the examination was in April, and I didn't pass by one course. One course was a couple of points under the required grade. And so I would have entered the Naval Academy with class of 54, but they didn't, because I didn't pass it, someone else got the appointment, and they elected because I guess I'd done pretty well, except for the one exam of a number of different exams they gave you. They decided to leave me, keep me there for another year, and enter the next following year.
Okay.
Which is what I did. I stayed there, and I played basketball for the Naval Academy Preparatory School, and I was a forward.
All right.
Again, still, I kept getting smaller as the kids kept getting bigger. And then the following year, I passed the examinations for the Naval Academy and entered with the class of 1955.
Okay. All right. Before we get you to Annapolis, could I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Sure.
About some of the courses and stuff that you were taking at the prep school. Could you tell me a little bit of what type of courses, that type of thing?
Yeah. The because the Navy curriculum as heavy in engineering courses, mathematics and science. The prep school taught us, I guess, the fundamentals of electronics and engineering, mathematics, and actually taught us to prepare us to take the examination.
Okay.
And so we were taking courses that prepared us for in areas of calculus, algebra, other math and science projects.
Okay.
And of course, a certain amount of what do I call it? Rounding, well-rounding things like literature and history,
mm-hmm.
and particularly Navy history, and I'm trying to think what else. Oh, they had us involved in physical fitness to keep us fit and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it's a well-rounded preparatory school. The Navy still runs it, and it's in I think it's in Newport, Rhode Island. We take at the time, the Navy took in, as I recall, about 160 young men from the fleet, if we call it, from the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and we
okay.
still do. A big proportion of those is actually athletes who might help Annapolis football and basketball teams
right.
compete. So I think they still do that.
Okay.
And you had other questions about that?
What was your favorite subject of the ones you were taking there? Did you have a...
Well, it was not necessarily engineering and math, although I had taken a college preparatory courses in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was not my strength. I thought that English literature and history and some of the so-called softer subjects were more interesting to me. By the way, I point this out that when my friend George Frazier called me, that was an absolutely life-changing moment in my life.
Mm-hmm. I imagine so.
And I've subsequently recognized him. If we ever get to that later in my life, I recognize him. To my friends in Pittsburgh, so they know that what a genuine person he was to remember me. Prep school was mostly helping us, prepping us for to take the examination, a set of questions related to math and science and that sort of thing.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And then so I guess we'll talk about Annapolis now, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I went to Annapolis. I would say that I was not the best sailor. Before I went to Annapolis, I was pretty heavy duty on enjoying my life and liberty and all the things that young kids do. But when I got to Annapolis, I got serious and became while academics were a struggle, I was recognized by my classmates and as some leadership potential and ended up with high marks and potential for officer potential. And I did play basketball for the freshman team at Annapolis the first year. By that time I was bordering on becoming a guard because the kids were getting bigger and faster and whatever. But the next year, I tried for the team and did not make the team. And that was the year when they brought in freshmen from let freshmen play varsity basketball, and they brought in some really good players. And
okay.
I was a little bit old in the tooth by that time. Anyway, then I went on to become a leader of in my class to. To become what we call a midshipman officer,
mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that very much. And then I had a, and I met my wife, my future wife, Barbara. And then I had a terrible thing happen. The at the end of my second class year, that would have been my, that would be the third year there. At the end of the year, just and about ready to go into my senior year, I failed a course in thermodynamics, and they gave me a re-exam, and I failed that, and they called me before the admiral, and they said, you can, you're going to have to stay an additional year if you want to go, if you want to stay in the Navy. And I had the GI Bill, and my future wife and I, we were engaged then, and discussed it, and we decided the Navy was for us, and so I did an additional year at the Naval Academy. Cruel punishment. They don't do that anymore, but they make you take, at that time they made you take the entire curriculum over one whole year.
Oh, wow.
If you had a problem with one course.
Mm, wow.
In any case, we survived that, and the following year I was made one of the ranking officers of the midshipmen, as a midshipman organization. And then the day after graduation, my wife and I, Barbara and I, married at the chapel, and went off on a career in the Navy.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, when? What, when did you graduate? What year was this?
1956.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit more about your time at the Naval Academy? Maybe like what a typical day was like, and something like that, if there was such a thing.
Yeah, I can. excuse me. As a freshman or a plebe, the first half of the year is extremely rigorous, and the upperclassmen are turned on to challenge the plebes mentally and physically to get them, get them fit for the rigors of the ocean experience, being at sea on ships and that sort of thing. And during that period, there's a weeding out process, and a great big number of probably some statistics show that upwards of a third of the class leave in that first 6 months, or certainly in that first year, because of one reason or another. They either discover that they didn't want to be in the military career in general, or that they really wanted to become something else than a naval officer. They may have wanted to become a doctor or a lawyer or something else.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just get fed up with being hassled by midshipmen, upperclassmen for such a long period of time. But it's a period where midshipmen have to, the plebes have to run around and answer questions and be very, very rigorous in terms of their uniforms and style and the work of the day. And sometime after Christmas and after the Christmas leave, the pressure on the plebes tends to slacken somewhat. And by the end of the first year, the plebe class is more relaxed, and when that year is finished, they go off on what's called a youngster cruise. They become a youngster. That's a second, that's a sophomore year. They become youngsters, and they're sent to sea for about 2 months on various ships, Navy ships that take them out and integrate them with the fleet sailors. And they learn hands-on operation of guns and machinery and navigation and all the things that ships do.
Okay.
And when they come back, they are then upperclassmen, and but sophomores now, and or youngsters as we call them, mm-hmm. and they're back to the academics of studying and making their way through the academics.
Right.
And it would not be a surprise that they tend to really enjoy themselves a little bit when they go on liberty and they relax a little bit and whatever, but they continue on with their sports and participating in physical activities.
Okay.
In the next year, the second class year, it's a junior year, the toughest year academically at the academy. There's no leadership requirements, although they're preparing to take over leadership of the brigade of midshipmen during that year. They examine you in navigation and engineering, steam propulsion, and an ugly word to me, thermodynamics, which I didn't do very well in. And then comes first class year, on top of the academics, which somewhat the pressure somewhat reduces for the seniors, and that's typical around the nation in any college. Last year is a little bit easier, but also then they take on leadership requirements, and the brigade of midshipmen is managed by themselves, by midshipmen. There are officers throughout the brigade of midshipmen acting more like mini deans, if you would, but there's just one officer per company of midshipmen, and the midshipmen are actually doing all the management of the day-to-day routine of the brigade. And then graduation, and off you go to your chosen career. In my case, I had two roommates, both of whom were going to flight training. One wanted to be a fighter pilot. The other one wanted to be a balloon pilot, a lighter-than-air pilot. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to become a surface officer, ship officer. But I was 25 by that time, older than most, and cutoff was, so they convinced me and I convinced myself to go to flight training. Barbara and I, we stayed to the Naval Academy after we married for about 2 months while I was, hold on a minute,
okay.
I'm in an interview. It's my wife just checking. I'm going to close my office door here. And I decided to go down there for flight training in Pensacola, and along about February, I decided it was not for me. I really wanted to be on ships, so my wife was pregnant, and we had to make the choice so that we could travel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we left flight training and went to join a ship. It was a newly commissioned ship that had been a World War II destroyer escort, and joined that ship. Became a damage control assistant, and we went to Newport, Rhode Island, where it was home ported, and then the ship was USS T.J. Gary, and it was one of the ships on the North Atlantic distant early warning line that spanned from the Azores across the North Atlantic, across North America and Canada, and across the North Pacific.
Okay.
And it consisted of radars that were focused in the direction of Russia.
Right.
Expecting that the Russians would be sending bombers to blow us to hell and back, whatever.
Right.
It never happened, and thank God, but it was interesting work that we did up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I loved the surface Navy and the sailors, and I found my niche in the Navy.
Okay.
And after about I became the chief engineer or department head on that ship, and then in 1958 I was cross-decked to USS Decatur, a new destroyer, and I was given a department, weapons department, I was a Lieutenant JG then, now, and I was, until 1960, I was weapons officer on the USS Decatur,
okay.
And we cruised into the Mediterranean and up the eastern or western side of Europe, spent 6 months in the Mediterranean trying to hunt down Russian submarines and whatever else that the Russians could mess with us.
Right.
With. Let's see, where am I? I guess we come to the end of my tour on the Decatur. I was, as weapons officer, I was involved with the Navy's newest guns at the time. Of course, there had been a lot of water under the dam in terms of weaponry, but at that time it was a 5-inch 54 rapid-fire gun, and it had a lot of problems, technical problems, and I spent a great deal of my time trying to sort out why the gun was having problems, but eventually became a excellent weapon, and served on ships later on that had those weapons on board, and they performed very well. At the close of the tour of duty on the Decatur, my wife and I, we had two babies, and we were on the edge of leaving the Navy. And I submitted my resignation to my commanding officer, and expecting that I would be discharged in 1960 at the end of my four-year tour period as an officer in the Navy. But it turns out that my captain called me in and said, I haven't sent your resignation to the Bureau of Naval Personnel yet, but I have a set of orders for you that you can take instead of leaving the Navy. You can go to Annapolis and become a company officer. So my wife and I talked it over, and we already had had a company a toy company up in Massachusetts wanted me to hire me as a production manager.
Okay.
But we decided to stay in the Navy. We went to Annapolis, and where I became a company officer, as I said before, like a mini dean. There, where there were 24 of us company officers, and I had the, if you would, the 11th company. And it was a marvelous experience. My wife and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We had our third child there. Toward the end of our second year, we were there from 60 to 62, and in 60 there were competitions among the midshipmen companies, and in the first year we were there, my company came in second, and then in the second year it came in first.
Okay.
And at the end of that second year, the Navy changed its rules and decided they were going to keep me at on shore duty an additional year, which didn't interest me too much. I wanted to go to sea, but they said the commandant asked me if I wanted to, what I wanted to do, and I said I don't want to do the same thing again. If I can, I'd like to do something interesting. And he said, well, we have a spot in West Point. You can go up there for a year as a company officer, or what they call a tactical officer there.
Okay.
And so Barbara and I agreed to go up to West Point and join the Corps of Cadets as the tactical officer for Company F2. And that was a marvelous year as well. Our officers up there treated us extremely well, and my kids enjoyed it, and we enjoyed it. And my company at West Point won the colors while we were there also.
Okay.
So, while I was there, I ran across neighbors who who had been to a little place called South Vietnam as advisors to the, that would have been in 63. Well, that was, I had never heard of Vietnam, such a little country, and I, so I, that's the first I heard about it. At the time, of course, America was worried about Cuba and the missile crisis, but more than Vietnam. But in any case, I learned that the Army had been sending advisors into Vietnam for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Navy was not involved at that time.
Right.
And at the end of that tour with the Army at West Point, I asked for command of a ship.
Okay.
And I was honored by being given, as a lieutenant in the Navy, given command of an ATF, ATF 101, USS Kokopa.
Okay.
It was a ocean-going towing and salvage ship with about four officers plus myself and about 65 enlisted men.
Okay.
And it was a just exciting, super thing. I loved every minute of it.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after I took command in the summer of 1963. Would be actually it was late early fall.
Mm-hmm.
I took command in the summer, and by early fall, I want to say September, October, I was deployed to the Western Pacific, and took a ship across the ocean. Nervous as the dickens, as one new officer might be, taking in command of a ship, taking across the ocean. But in case, it turned out to be an interesting and exciting thing to do. And I got to Guam, and we were notified that President Kennedy had been assassinated.
Right.
And the crew and I all went across. Went to the local Catholic church and then sent a message to Mrs. Kennedy and that was a very sad time.
Sure.
And then, as a point of note, Mrs. Kennedy later sent us a nice thank you note for. We sent her a message back from the crew of the ship. And we went on to the Philippines, and then we went up had a went and over to Cambodia, did some work there. And on the way back, we were ordered into Vung Tau, a coastal city on the coast of South Vietnam.
Right.
And then we were we had a tow, and we were ordered to take the tow. It was a small PGM, a patrol boat, take it to Saigon, which we did. And during so, we were ordered to get into combat gear and man our weapons, and and we went up through the place called the Rungsat Special Zone,
right,
on the Long Tao Channel to get to Saigon, and that was the first time I ever heard of the Rungsat Special Zone and the Long Tao Channel, as a matter of fact. We went up to Saigon and stayed there, and we were there the day before Christmas. We were there for Christmas and a day after Christmas. And when we turned over the boat, and while we were there, the deputy commander of the U.S. Military Assistance Command Vietnam was the newly arrived former commandant of cadets at West Point, General William Stilwell.
Okay.
And I made contact with him, had a Christmas dinner with him, and he came aboard the ship and asked me about what do we do about all these rivers down in South Vietnam, and I didn't have much to add, but he was starting to figure out how to contain the insurgents that were in the South Vietnam and in the Delta region where right. all these rivers were. Anyway, we then left left Vietnam, and we did a few other minor things around in those waters, and then and went back to the Philippines, and eventually went back to the States.
Okay.
Take a sip of coffee, please.
Sure, sure. I'd like to ask you a few questions about this anyway.
About what?
I'd like to ask you about a few questions about your duty while you were in Vietnam at this
yeah.
time. Was there much of a U.S. naval presence at this time?
In Vietnam, about
yeah.
in 63, this was 1963,
right.
the winter 63-64, mm-hmm. I was there for Christmas, 63, and that, oh, by the way, the, I think it was it DM?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was assassinated
right.
just before we arrived.
Okay.
And there was heavy, heavy security. There was not much Navy in Vietnam, although I've subsequently learned that there were some small detachments of Navy and Marines into the Delta
mm-hmm.
in an attempt to figure out how to defend those rivers and protect the people down there.
Okay.
But not the activity hadn't really started. If you recall, we had in the history of this thing, President Eisenhower decided not to help the French at Dien Bien Phu.
Right, right.
But he brought we did help bring the refugees down to South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and so we were, and we did put in a small mission, military mission in South Vietnam. But it was mostly Army, and to my knowledge, there wasn't much Navy there
okay.
in that period.
All right. Now, what was your, you said since you spent a few days in Saigon around Christmas time and just going in and out of the rivers and doing your job at that time, what was your first impressions of Vietnam at that time?
My impression in Saigon, and that was, I mean, coming up through the... Rungsat on the Long Tao Channel. First of all, I had never navigated a river like that, and I had to take I did. I took a Vietnamese captain with me who knew the river and gave him control of the ship because it would have taken us 15 days to get up that river the way I. As scared as I was of the river, it was the Long Tao Channel is a really snake-like, if you would, as a description, snake-like river. It just weaves and whatever, and has some really treacherous areas. You have to be very careful in your navigation. And we were at general quarters the entire trip. It was hot as a dickens, as I recall, notwithstanding that it was December. And so I thought that we were in a hornet's nest on the way up there. I had no idea, except that's what we were told, and that there were guerrillas waiting to attack the ships on the Long Tao Channel. So we were a little tense. Once we got to Saigon, the tenseness relaxed because it seemed like Saigon was at that time a very peaceful place. It was they just killed their president,
right.
and the army had taken over and locked it down, and my sailors actually we gave them a few hours liberty up there, and they seemed to enjoy themselves. But on Christmas Day, my crew came to me and said, "Hey, can we do something for the Vietnamese?" And as great American sailors do, they found a couple of orphanages and brought kids from orphanages aboard the ship for Christmas supper, Christmas dinner, and showed him around and gave him a T-shirt with the Chip's name on it, caps and all that sort of thing, and
right.
they just had a grand time. I was not, I did not feel that, I did not feel danger mm-hmm. in Saigon at that time. I traveled to my boss's or the McVee's headquarters and back in an open Jeep, and I wasn't armed, and neither, as I recall, was the driver of the Jeep.
Right.
So it was not for me. I didn't feel danger
mm-hmm.
At that time.
Okay. All right, and while you were going up the Long Tao Channel and going through the Rungsat Special Zone and or near that, you never came under any fire or anything like that at all.
No, we didn't. No, we did not. We were, of course, this pilot that I took aboard asked me how fast I could go, and I said this ship will go about 18 knots, sir, and he said, take it to 18 knots.
Right.
And he raced that ship up there. I was biting my nails. I said, there goes my career. If he misses a turn, I'll be up in the mud for a month.
Right.
But he knew what he was doing, and we didn't make any he was aware that there were possibility of people out there that would take shots at us, and wasn't mm-hmm. going to take any chances of going up slow.
Okay.
So it worked fine.
Right. All right. And you mentioned the tow job that you did there. Can you tell what kind of ship you were towing and what that was about?
Well, actually, I can tell you what it's about. It was an interesting story. We were sent. I was in the let's see. It would have been in early December. I was in the Philippines. And I, in the middle of the night, I got a message, super secret message that said, get underway and head west. And I, new captain, I questioned, is that really true? Do they really want me to do that? But they did, and so we got the crew back aboard, as many as I could. I think we had to leave a couple on the shore that we couldn't find. But we got everybody back and got underway within about 2 hours, and I headed west. And once I was headed west, I sent a message back to my boss and said, I'm doing what you told me to do. And he said, okay, now go to Cambodia and lay out of sight to a place called Rayam, Cambodia, and lay out of sight of land. So we did that, and that took us around the Parrot's Peak and up into the Gulf of Siam, etc. And we laid out of sight off maybe 60, 80 miles at sea, out of sight of the land, until the ambassador of Cambodia and my commander sent me a message and told me to go into the port of Rayam, Cambodia, and take possession of a PGM. That's a patrol boat, guns,
mm-hmm.
and was made. I think it was a very sleek, beautiful boat that we were intending to turn over to the Cambodian Navy for coastal warfare. And but what happened was is that the Prince Sihanouk, as I recall his name was, told the United States to, he has several relations with the United States, and told us to take our forces out of Cambodia.
Mm. Right.
So we did, and we happened to have this boat ready to turn over to the Cambodian Navy, and we decided to take it back and not give it to the Cambodian Navy, so I was ordered in to take it under tow and bring it out.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way out, I did that. And on the way out, we faced down the Cambodian Navy. They didn't try to force me to take the booth from me, but it was a little bit tense for a while. And then we left and got to sea and headed back toward the Philippines, and that's when they we ended up in a major storm.
Okay.
And I was ordered into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and to turn over that boat to the Vietnamese.
Okay. How did the situation with the Cambodians come to a conclusion? I mean, did they eventually just move out of the way and just?
Yeah, what happened is they had a destroyer, a destroyer escort that was originally looked to me like it was originally an American or French ship,
mm-hmm.
and they had it at sea. And when I came out, they were in a blocking position, but they came to what you call general quarters, and we did too. We were just a little dinky ship compared to, and they had a full destroyer escort and a band with their sailors, but they didn't take any action. They just put on a show for us, and we sailed on by, went on about our business, and that was it.
Okay. All right. Were there any other? Did you have any other of these tow job type missions while you were in Vietnam?
Not in Vietnam.
Okay.
On leaving Vietnam, we had been out. we had been on this mission up in Cambodia and in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We missed Christmas, and we had Christmas in Saigon.
Right.
We missed Christmas in the Philippines, and on the way home to the Philippines, we were ordered to do another major salvage operation off the north coast of Luzon,
mm-hmm.
and it was a Philippine Navy ship. Had run aground up there, so we went up and with a couple other American salvage ships, and we pulled the Philippine ship off the island,
mm-hmm.
and then we went back to the Philippines, and
okay.
we missed New Year's,
mm-hmm.
so you know how sailors are. We got back to the Philippines, and I said, "Okay, I'll give you some liberty, and you can have a belated New Year's Eve party," which they did.
Right.
And we did. What else did we do? Trying to think now. We did some operations up in Japan. Nothing as serious as the Vietnam stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. They were mostly delivered some things.
Okay.
Pick up some stuff one port, take it to another port,
right.
That sort of thing.
Okay.
And but it was a very exciting tour of duty.
Sure. Yeah, I guess being your first command and all, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. How long were you in command of the Cocopa? Is that how you
say? Yeah, about a year and a half.
Year and a half, okay.
Year and a half. And then the Navy cross-decked me again to a USS Morton,
mm-hmm.
a destroyer, DD. I know what the ship's all about.
Right.
DD-948.
Okay.
And I was cross-decked as executive officer of that ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then that ship had just come back from a tour of duty in Western Pacific. And so we went into overhaul for a couple of months up in Long Beach. And then we deployed back to the war zone in South Vietnam. And on that ship, that was in 64, in that ship we did gunfire support for in a northern zone, zone one up in northern part below the DMZ and above
right.
the DMZ, as a matter of fact. We fired, I was exec and combat officer, and Skipper was a wonderful guy who was fearless with his destroyer. And when they wanted, when the Army and the Marine Corps and sometimes the Australians wanted gunfire support, we would run in and satisfy them. We got really good reports back in terms of our accuracy of our gunfire. We fired over 10,000 rounds of 5-inch 54 guns. The same gun that I had so much trouble with on the Decatur
right.
was now proven and was doing very well. We had three of them on board, and we were a prized gunfire ship by the people on shore because it had pretty good range, and our team was pretty accurate, and we fired gunfire support to four advisors, as well as regular Army and Marine Corps units who would be within our range, and maybe being attacked, we would give them support, and so we did that for 6 months.
Okay. All right. And you said you were on the Morden from fall of 64 until 66?
Yeah, I was there. I went, we came back from the deployment in 64, and then we overhauled the ship, prepared it again, and deployed again, and I went back out to Vietnam, the Vietnam War Zone, did some more gunfire support, and
right.
I was relieved as exec of that ship in 66.
Okay.
And in the summer of 66, like I think June, and then I went up to Monterey for graduate school.
Okay.
In the summer of 66,
right.
as I recall, it was like July or August. School started in late August or September.
Okay. Before we talk about grad school, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your duty on the Morton, if you don't
sure.
mind.
Sure, sure.
So you were on duty at the Morton by the fall of 64. Were you anywhere in the area when the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred?
Actually, the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened the year that I went to Morton
mm-hmm.
as exec.
Okay.
The ship had just come back from being out in the Tonkin Gulf area.
Right.
But it was not involved in that incident of the...
right.
Let me see. What were the two ships?
Turner Joy and...
Turner Joy and one other.
Yeah.
And they were both... they were in our squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I will tell you this, that... I said that they were not involved in that specific action
mm-hmm.
with the Turner Joy and the, if I can think of the name of the ship, terrible.
Yeah.
But they were involved, they were in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the ship, because of the Tonkin Gulf incident and mm-hmm. the possibility that they had that those two ships had been attacked. When Morton went into the Gulf of Tonkin, the ship went in and in a high, highly defensive posture.
Right.
And our kids thought that we were being attacked. In one cruise through the Tonkin Gulf, and we had a Commodore on board. There were two ships, Morton and I forget which other one. And the ship went to general quarters and fired rounds at things that that, according to the CIC people and the radar operators, looked like small boats. Fired lots of rounds and then came out and never. And we learned later that they were not ships, but Morton did defend itself and fire. And that there was a division of two ships that did that. And I subsequently, I'm an active member of the Morton crew veterans organization, and we have discussed that backwards and forwards. And the sailors who were aboard Morton on that period when they went up in the Gulf, some say they swear that they were being attacked, and others say, poo-poo, it's not true, and, you know, so we're kind of, we still mull it around, and since I wasn't there, all I do is listen and give guidance and try to digest what they say. But it was a tense period, and it was, they all felt like they were in combat. But I wasn't there.
Right. Okay. So you ended up, you were on the Morton after it had already come back to the U.S. for refitting. That's whenever you joined
I'm sorry, say that again. I'm having a, my let me tell you, I'm up in my office, and my, I have a, I hire a company that comes and cuts my grass, and they're here now.
Okay.
So I'm trying to block out any sound background noise.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But so you joined the Morton after it come back to the U.S. for refitting? Is
yes.
That correct? Okay.
Yeah, I did in the summer of, I'm not sure, it was the summer, must have been, maybe it was the fall of 1964, I think
right.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah, when I finished up, you see, yeah, it was about something like the winter of 64. I left CO of, I was relieved as CO of Kokopo and went over and became executive of the destroyer.
How did you feel about no longer being the commanding officer? How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, I'm a fairly flexible guy. I think that my attitude was that while Kokopo was a real highlight of my Navy career, I loved that tour. It was only a year and a half. I figured that I'm going to have lots and lots of interesting things to do in the Navy, one of which would be the number one to another captain. And I didn't have a problem. I felt my job was to support the skipper.
Sure.
While I might have missed being the CO, lucky for me, and I was greatly honored to have four other commands in the Navy. So I made up for it.
Right.
Exec was a trying is a trying job for anybody in the Navy career. The number two guy has a lot of pressure on them, and it's an important job.
Right. Okay. And what would the specific duties of the XO be on, say, the Morton?
Well, I think pretty much the same on any ship. He's the executive officer has the staff of the ship, the wardroom of the ship, works for the XO and carries out the policies of the who carries out the policies of the commanding officer. Are challenged daily in terms of keeping the commanding officer informed and discussing today's matters and the future of the ship and that sort of thing with the CO, then your job is to work with the wardroom and the chief's quarters to make sure that the ship is manned and fit to fight. And they're involved in making sure all the equipment is working and that people are trained and that the young sailors who the captain is entrusted with are doing their job and are cared for.
Hello. Set the recording here again real quick.
Yeah.
Okay, you were telling me about the duties of the XO.
Right. Yeah, and, taking care of making sure that the kids, the great young kids, 18, 19-year-old sailors on board that are doing fine
right.
Helping them keep them marching along.
Okay. All right, well, you mentioned a little earlier about the fire support. Could you tell me, do you remember any specific incidents or specific happenings with that that you could tell me about?
Sure.
Okay.
Let me think now. Well, first of all, the coastal waters of South Vietnam, the war zone, were mirrored on the war zones of South Vietnam, and they were divided into four corps.
Right.
And the I Corps, First Corps, was up near the DMZ. And most of the shore bombardment was in support of the fighting on shore.
Right.
But the gunfire ships also went to Second Corps and Third Corps and even down to Fourth Corps when needed.
Right.
And Morton provided shore bombardment for the 3rd Corps and 1st Corps.
Okay.
And we did some shore bombardment, would you believe, in the up close to the Rungsat Special Zone in support of advisors in the Rungsat.
Wow.
And we also did a lot of shore bombardment for the Marines and soldiers, Army, and in the I Corps.
Okay.
I remember because it's so close to me. I ended up being the senior advisor of the Rungsat Special Zone, which we'll talk about later. At the time, I had already been there once when I was skipper of the Kokopah.
Right.
But we had a call for fire to support senior support advisors in the Rungsat, and my captain, Captain Bob Bodimer, it was one of those things that said we're getting overrun. We need your gunfire support. Get here as soon as you can. And they gave us. I would be in combat. The captain was on the bridge, and we were in brown water.
Uh-huh.
And they gave us the coordinates of the firefight that was going on, and my captain raced the ship at high speed in brown water, risking our ships to get within range, And of course, then he slowed down, and we started firing. And it was an exciting period because we had been originally pretty far out, and we closed the gap and got within range and provided first the star shells over high above the battlefield, the battle, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was between visors and some. It could have been North Vietnamese or insurgents. I don't know which.
Okay.
But we've got fired star shells, and then we changed to high explosives, and we drove off. We were. We got a report back later that we were successful in driving off and winning the battle in the Rungsat, and that would have been in 65.
Okay.
And then we had several really interesting missions up in the I Corps area. In one specific instance, an advisory group with the Vietnamese Army was being overrun, and they needed fire support from us, and we went as close as we could to the beach,
mm-hmm.
and fired as far as we could, as far as our guns would reach, our projectors would reach to support these. The Australian advisors were with the Vietnamese Army.
Mm.
And we got a message back that said, hey, you saved our ass. They were being overrun. They even wanted us to fire on top, which meant you fire right on top of the both where the battle is. And fortunately, we didn't wound or kill any of our own people, but we did fire some rounds in that area,
right,
and close to them, and it was a very successful operation. It all those messages related to those combat ops and for shore bombardment that I had were in the Texas Tech library.
Right. Okay.
I don't recall that I had how much I had, but whatever I had, I turned in with my papers to the archives.
Right. Yes.
So there, whatever's there, and then of course the Morton veterans. Various veterans had their memories of those firefights, or not firefights, but shore bombardments, and they're very and some of them still have some paperwork or messages or something. I couldn't tell you who or what, but we talk about them often at our reunions. You know, the incidents have grown larger and larger and larger in our minds.
Right.
Actually, they're fun to do.
Uh-huh. You mentioned Americans and American soldiers, American advisors, and Australians and such being able to call in fire support from you guys. Would the South Vietnamese themselves be able to, or did they have to have an advisor?
No, they had to have an advisor. They had to have an English speaker. We had, of course, naval gunfire support liaison officers with them, with the advisory, and they were our contact. They would call us on a gunfire support circuit,
mm-hmm.
on a frequency. And also, some of those NGLOs, Naval Gunfire Support, people were in airplanes as well.
Okay.
And they would fly over the battlefield and help us adjust fire, as did the officers who were on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They would call for fire, tell us where the, give us the coordinates of the firefight, give us a, coordinates of front lines. They would give us the coordinates of the enemy and whatever else needed, and then they would adjust fire. We'd fire several rounds, and then the naval gunfire support liaison person would move it to the right or left or farther out, adjust the range, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
And then once we were on target, they'd give the command fire for effect, and we would pump it out.
Right, right. Okay.
And I would have to say that, of course, the USS Morton was the very best destroyer operating in South Vietnamese waters during that period of time.
Yeah.
We think so, anyway.
Right. Well, do you know if the Morton supported Operation Starlight? Do you know if that was part of one of the support positions?
I don't remember that name.
Okay.
I don't know what the Starlight...
Okay, I was just curious. That was one of the first Marine operations upon after... I believe it happened in March of 65, soon after the landings, the first aggressive operation by the Marines.
Mm-hmm. Tell you the truth, I don't...
Okay.
It doesn't strike me.
Right.
We were... I just don't remember that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So you said you were in support of the ground forces there for about 6 months, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the rest of the time on the Morton, what were you guys doing?
Well, after the operation in 65,
mm-hmm.
That would have been, let me think now, 65, we finished that 6 month deployment. It went back to the States,
uh-huh.
And prepped to redeploy, and we redeployed in 66.
Okay.
And provided gunfire support, and the ship, while I got relieved out there in the summer of 66, to go to Monterey, the ship, I was relieved in Taiwan, as I recall, and the ship, they were up there for just a short R&R, and then they went back to the combat line, the shore bombardment line, and shore support, and they did marvelous work. They fired as many projectiles or even more,
mm-hmm.
than we did on the first cruise.
Okay.
So the ship went right back to war. I saw about half of the second cruise,
mm-hmm.
before I was relieved.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Do you know how long the Morton stay? When did the Morton leave Vietnam for the last time? I mean, how long was it there, I guess?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't have that history, although I'll tell you,
sure.
this, that there is, you know, it was important I could find it, because Morton has a website and has a history of the ship, and you can find anything you want.
Okay.
About the ship.
All right.
Sure.
Okay. All right, then. Was the Morton... and were you in Vietnamese waters whenever the first Americans came ashore in March of 65? Were you in the area?
No.
Okay.
No.
Right. Okay, then. All right.
Now I take it back. The ship may have been there,
but,
okay?
Right, but you were already gone.
But I was still in command of Kokopa.
Okay.
And I just... all I did was walk across. When I was relieved, I walked across and took exec of Morton. But he had just returned from the Western Pacific and in the war zone.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, if there's nothing else to talk about with the Morton, we can move on to Naval Post Grad School. Or is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Mm. not on the Morton.
Okay.
It was exciting and interesting tour duty out, and wouldn't change it for the world.
Right.
And then at grad school, my wife and I and the kids went up there, and I was just there for 1 year,
mm-hmm.
and I got a master's degree in economic systems analysis, and relaxing, and got back from the excitement of the war zone.
Right.
Relaxed and came back to normal, I guess.
Is this something you applied for or were just assigned to?
The Navy has a system, and I assume they still have a similar system. I'm sure it's changed somewhat. They ask officers and to a certain extent enlisted men nowadays, what would you like to do next?
Right.
And you are given two or three options. You can, what's your first choice, second choice, third choice? And one of my choices was that I wanted to go and get a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that was on the card.
Okay.
And when it came to touring me off of Morton, they toured me to my first choice, which was graduate school.
Uh-huh.
And they sent me to Monterey, to the Navy postgraduate school at Monterey, which is one of the finest schools in the nation. Little understood, not well known, because it's all for military, but it's a great school.
Okay. All right. And you said you were there for a year, so from 66 until 67?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And what you mentioned a little bit about your classes and things, but could you tell me a little bit more about the types of classes you were taking and the training? And
well, part of it, the beginning class, everybody who was a student there, with some exceptions, I'm sure, are coming back from sea duty. It's something if the war, whatever war we happen to be in, permits you to go to shore duty, they bring you back from sea duty to shore duty, and it's part of counts as part of your shore duty.
Okay.
And so you go to school in civilian clothes,
mm-hmm.
and study rigorously. And you're assigned to a specialty, depending, I suppose, on your preference and to a certain extent your academic prowess.
Okay.
For instance, if you wanted to get a master's degree in physics, you probably would have had to have had a Bachelor of Science in Physics or something like that to do that.
Okay.
In my case, I was interested in management and to a certain extent economics, and that's the curriculum that they put me in. And it was very rigorous and lots of hard work, lots of study, and worked fine for me.
Okay. All right. Did you find, was there any difficulty adjusting from say being the XO of a ship to shore duty in grad school? Was there any difficulty?
Personally, for me, it was not. I took it to its for what the reality was, that you were a student and you were no longer in loss of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Except your grades and your family, and I did not have a problem. However, one of my closest friends had a terrible problem.
Mm-hmm.
He could not adjust to the academics, the pressures of academics. And he had just come from being CEO of his own ship, and he just on one day just stood up in class and walked out and went up to the superintendent and said, "I quit, and send me back to the Navy." And so there were incidents. That's a data point of one.
Right.
There were incidences where guys come back from being a company commander with the Marines or whatever they were doing operationally, and come back and can't and are not ready to settle down and put in the time, quiet time that you need to study. It happens.
Okay.
I guess you probably, in retrospect, what we now know about PTSD is probably a version of that, my guess is, anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, how would you evaluate your education that you received there?
I've been fortunate. I got through the Naval Academy by the skin of my teeth, I guess. Actually, it took me 5 years. I loved the Naval Academy curriculum, and it was except for thermodynamics. I enjoyed being there, and then I was 10 years out of the academy. They let me go back to school for another year,
right.
And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I became aware of the concept of continuing education, and that year up there working for a master's degree was perfect for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it, very broadening, and gave me an opportunity to sink my teeth into academics again.
Right.
And I couldn't have had a better experience.
Okay. Did you have a desire to go back to commanding ships again there?
Actually, I did have a latent feeling that I wanted to command in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
Whenever my time was ready, I would want to go. I wanted command of a destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already been the CEO of my own ship, and I'd been executive destroyer. I was ready to be a captain of a destroyer. But it wasn't going to happen right away, because I was just coming back from sea duty, and they weren't going to send me back to sea duty. So they came out to Monterey and determined that I should go back to the Bureau of Naval Personnel.
Okay.
And that's what I did for 2 years, from 67 through 69. I was what we call an assignment officer in the Bureau of Naval Personnel for Navy Lieutenant Commanders.
Okay.
I assigned them from sea duty to shore duty and sent them to places like the faculty, staff, the E-ring of the Pentagon or whatever.
Okay. All right. So this, your job was to... But transferring them from sea duty to shore duty.
Yeah, I would have to. We have the system. The Navy system is military. Well, I don't think it's any different than personnel or human resources, as we call it today. We have a high turnover rate in the Navy. In general, we have a high turnover rate on our ships at as much as 50-60% a year. Half the ship is going somewhere else, and others are coming to the ships. And then we have to assign them to we want to assign them to our shore facilities. And in order to do that, we have a system. Today, I'm sure it's all done electronically. When I was there, it was manually. and we keep track of where the officers are, and we have a little bit of an idea of where their career pattern, what jobs are in, they're in line for their career pattern. And our job is to track them down maybe 3 months before they're ready to leave leave their current duty, and to a certain extent negotiate with them to where they're going to go for their next duty. And once we have decided and where the proper place is for them to go concerning their careers, and what their druthers are, we then cut a set of orders and send the orders to the officer. And once he's relieved, then he carries out his orders and goes to the next job.
Okay.
And I would go to the men who were at sea and bring them ashore duty.
Okay. All right. What was your rank at this time?
I was lieutenant commander.
Okay. All right. Were any of these guys assigned to shore duty in Vietnam?
Yeah. And I had that. That was part of my job too. I had assigned them. Well, we had a special desk that that carried all the billets that were war zone billets in Vietnam, and I had to work with them to bring people to them who might be ready to serve ashore. We didn't always take men who were coming off of sea duty or the war zone and then send them back in country. We had to be careful somewhat of that we didn't back-to-back of into combat. We had to keep those billets filled, and I was there 67 to 69 during the greatest buildup of our Navy in South Vietnam. It was a real busy time. I was not a very popular officer in the Navy personnel business, because I was sending almost every other guy that I had assigned was going to going in country Vietnam, because some of the jobs in Vietnam were considered sea duty jobs. Those in the riverine warfare were considered sea duty jobs, and some of them were considered shore duty jobs, like if you were in a desk job at MACV. They were all in the war zone, though, and for purposes of combat duty and that sort of thing. So we had to assign a lot of people into Vietnam for a year of duty there. Some on the rivers and some on desk jobs, et cetera, wherever they were needed.
Right.
And it was not a popular time. It was guerrilla warfare, particularly in the South.
Sure.
And a lot of the guys, there were a lot of people who didn't want to do that.
Did you have to, when assigning them to Vietnam, would you have to take into consideration things like health, pregnancy of the wives being pregnant, things like that?
Well, I'll tell you, Jason, I think we spend more time on the human side today than we did in those days.
Okay.
It was a war.
Right.
We spent a certain amount of time, and there were certain things, certain times when we could negotiate that sort of thing. But was not a major element of our decision making. Our decision making was we have a job in the war, and we need a body to do that job. And it may sound brutal, but and to a certain extent it was. We, there were a lot of people who did not want to go.
Right.
And so, you know, it was not an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, that's the way it is in wartime. But on the other hand, I'll say this: the number of people who did want to go were a very fraction of the men who marched off and did their took their assignment and did what they had to do without any whining.
Right. Did you have a lot of cases of people trying to get out of assignment to Vietnam?
Not really. I had a few. I had one major incident. I had a superb lieutenant commander, exec of a destroyer in Norfolk, Virginia, who was working for a then former submarine officer who was captain of the destroyer. I wanted to send the guy from executive destroyer in Atlantic into the riverine warfare business in Vietnam, and his boss made a big fuss about me sending this superstar lieutenant commander into Vietnam. And I was asked to look at the assignment, and it turned out that the officer did go in country, and he was a superstar in the riverine warfare business, and highly decorated, Silver Star, et cetera, et cetera, and worked out fine.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I'm trying to think of what else I can ask you about these duties. Let's see. You were at this position, you said, for about 2 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Following your assignment here, where did you go next?
I'm sorry?
Following your assignment with the Bureau of Naval Personnel. You were then assigned, let's see, to what, Assistant Chief of Staff for Logistics?
No, actually, the next thing I did was went up to Newport, Rhode Island for 1 year.
Okay.
As to the Naval War College.
Oh, right. That's one of the gaps I missed there.
Then I went out to First Fleet Staff as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Logistics.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the Naval War College?
Well, what do you say about that? It's there are I think a half dozen war colleges in America: the Air War College, the National War College. Army has several war colleges, so there's quite a few of them, and we send our mid rank officers to for 1 year intense discussion about warfare and why we do it and how we do it and the strategy of warfare and tactics and that sort of thing.
Right.
And we also have all the war colleges are divided into junior and senior, and the seniors are usually commanders or captains. And I had I hadn't been promoted to commander yet, so I was at the junior course at the Naval War College, and that course was focused on day-to-day tactics and naval warfare and how it integrated with the other armed forces, et cetera.
Okay. Was there any sort of specific focus on Vietnam or more general?
Well, all of us there, by this time, almost all of the students had been in the war zone one time or another.
Right.
So we talked about it a lot. Everybody, and we had Marines and Navy officers there, and we even had a few Army officers. There was a few civilians who went there, and they were considered the war colleges are considered a broadening experience for any career person in government. So lots of civilians come up from State Department and Defense Department and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So we did talk about Vietnam. Everybody had a different story to tell, as you probably know in doing these things, that everybody's story is different in the war zone and in our longest hot war.
Sure.
And Air Force and Navy, Coast Guard, Army, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody did something different.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They have a little piece of what that warfare was about. So we talked about that.
Right.
And it was very broadening discussions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And along this time period, since you've been away from Vietnam, and we'll talk later on, of course, about your assignment as advisor. But this time period since you left Vietnam after the Morton and Naval post grad school, and had you been keeping up with how the war had been going at that time? Were you following it fairly closely? Or?
Yeah, I think I followed it as closely as I could. I read the newspapers, watched the television. There was no in the Bureau of Naval Personnel. We were focused on our specific jobs of signing the officers to their next jobs, and
right.
Had very little time to do any philosophical discussions other than maybe a lunchtime beer or something like that, or coffee around in the breaks and whatever, but not a lot. War College gave us an opportunity to think about it a little bit, I had not been since the day that my the commandant of West Point challenged me to to help him figure out what to do in the Delta. I never thought much about it.
Right.
Again, after War College, I went out to be chief of staff for logistics, which was actually, it was interesting. I just been promoted to commander, and they sent me out in a captain's billet, and so that I guess they wanted me to have a job near on the admiral's personal staff and get a feeling for what a major operational staff operated like, because I had not had a C assignment, a staff job.
Right.
And I guess that's the reason they sent me there. And they were beginning to focus me on a subspecialty of logistics.
Okay.
So that's probably why they went. I was there for 1 year.
Okay.
And then they sent me orders to go in country to be a senior advisor in Nabe.
Right. Okay. Before we get to that, could we talk a little bit more about this, job description with the, just tell me a little bit more about the job with the Chief of Staff for Logistics.
Yeah, excuse me, the Admiral was a three-star, and there were Admiral Ike Kidd and Vice Admiral Ray Peet were the commanders that I worked for during that year, and my job for them, Ike Kidd eventually made four-star, and he was very much into logistics. He wanted to know, he wanted me to look at sustainability at sea from a logistics point of view, maintaining the force at sea. How could we do that? How could we move parts around the fleet? How could we keep them in battle on a sustainable period? How could we best get them ready from a logistics point of view, from a engineering and point of view, and to monitor? He wanted me to look at how we got ships ready to deploy and how we kept them in warfighting condition at sea during a period of combat or I did a lot of statistical analysis for I had a very small staff. I had a couple reserve officers come in and work for me, we met a major part of the major training exercises at the fleet level.
Okay.
With carriers and cruisers and destroyers and submarines and the whole bit, and we looked at logistics in a sustainable warfare environment.
Okay.
And so I did that for a year.
Right.
And turned out a couple of reports and we did deploy to Hawaii for major fleet exercises, and it was an interesting job for 1 year.
Okay. All right. Well, before we get into your assignment as the chief advisor in Rungsat and your return to Vietnam, take a break real quick. You mind?
Sure.
Okay. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Dr. Carl Nelson. Today is September 5th, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Dr. Nelson is joining me once again from Chula Vista, California. Okay, yesterday when we left off, you were just about to get your assignment
right
to your in-country duty in Vietnam. And so why don't we begin there? If you will, could you tell me a little bit about when you received these orders, and what was your reaction to them?
Let's see. I must have received them after Christmas in 1971.
Okay.
Or January 72.
Okay.
I was not surprised. I was expecting them. Got the heads up from the detailers that they were going to move me from the First Fleet to in country, and and they were going to give me a CO job there, senior advisor for the logistics support base at Na Bay. It was sounded interesting to me, and we began training, and I'm trying to remember, I think went in country in, I want to say, March.
Okay.
Went in country in March, and in between they sent me to survival. I guess you're familiar with this, I guess. SEER training.
Yes, sir.
And they sent me to that, and then they sent me to the amphib base for cultural training.
Okay.
Which was valuable, and language school.
Mm-hmm.
At that school, they tried to teach me about 200 Vietnamese words,
right,
and understand the Vietnamese culture, and culture was most interesting. The language was difficult.
Right.
But I did learn a few and took them with me.
And, okay.
Then I shipped out to Vietnam in, can't remember exactly when, in March,
mm-hmm.
fairly early, I think. And on arrival, made a call on the Commander Naval Force Vietnam, and then took a jeep ride down to the Rungsat, which was not too far from Saigon in terms of distance and in terms of road miles and junk on the road and all sorts of strange cultural things. It might as well have been 300 miles or 1,000 miles, who knows. But the base was fairly modern. We had built up the area of Na Bay, fenced it in, built some decent barracks,
mm-hmm.
lots of logistics warehouses.
Yeah,
we had a place to put up ships, small ships,
mm-hmm.
fairly actually up to probably probably taking LST.
Okay,
and it was almost a shipyard. It was not as big as the Vietnamese had a shipyard in Saigon. It was quite large, but
mm-hmm.
Na Bay was probably the second largest shipyard in Vietnam, as far as I know.
Okay.
And we had, when I got there, probably had 100 advisors in the logistics base. And then the other command that was stationed there was the Rungsat advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rungsat advisors were actually they were the operational organization.
Mm-hmm.
They had Marines and sailors. Sailors operated the boats out of Na Bay on the Long Tao Channel.
Mm.
And there was a separate senior advisor at the time. My counterpart as senior advisor of the Rungsat was Lyle Armel.
Okay.
And then I had headquarters there, adjacent to him or nearby, and I had the all the warehouses. My counterpart was a Vietnamese engineering specialist, a commander,
mm-hmm.
and he was the CEO of the logistics base, and I was his advisor. My American advisors were advisors to his sailors.
Okay.
And we had repair capability for PBRs and whatever and other vessels that minesweeps whatever that happened to get shot up or out of repair and we had all the supplies for that area, and I had quite a few supply people with me, and other technicians. The beauty of that time, as I recall, is that we were at the point where we were no longer Navy was no longer taking draftees into Vietnam. They were all volunteers.
Right.
and they were terrific guys. They were people who were, a lot of them were career sailors, and completely committed to serving. And I, during the short period that I was senior advisor to the logistics base there, which is only about 2 months, I had absolutely no problems. The sailors were so good, and I think the Vietnamese, my Vietnamese counterpart had some problems with his sailors, but I didn't have any with American sailors. And about 2 months into that job, Lyle Armel was selected for captain and moved to Saigon, and I was given made senior advisor of the Rungsat Special Zone as well as the logistics support base.
Okay.
And we, within a month or so, we merged them into one command.
Okay.
And so that moves us down into, so then I had a operational hat and I had a logistics command hat or senior advisor hat. So my counterpart on the Rungsat's side was a Vietnamese Navy captain. And he was in command of everything that was in everything that was in the Rungsat.
Okay.
And I don't know, Rungsat Special Zone included the Na Bay base, and 1, 2, 3, 4 outlying bases in towns, in villages, where we had a small contingent of Marines. And we had the river itself all the way from Saigon. Well, let's see, no, somewhat short of Saigon, but certainly north of where, or rather west of where we were, and all the way to Vung Tau, to the ocean.
Okay.
And our responsibilities were to protect the river, principally. Now, Rungsat, of course, depends on who the translator is. The Rungsat in Vietnamese means either killer forest or forest of assassins.
Right, right.
And you, I guess you know that. And we, the Long Tao Channel was the only deep water channel from the ocean to Saigon, and it carried. We had ships coming and going all the time, with coming up the river to offload oil at the oil tank farms, or go into Saigon and offload tanks or other logistics ordered by the field commanders. And the Long Tao Channel pretty much supported the logistics. Came up the river, pretty much supported the 3rd and 4th Corps.
Okay.
I think 2nd Corps and I Corps were supported by ports north of where we were. And on the river we had, and by the way, I did publish a discussion of the Rungsat. I don't know if you have that or not.
Right. Okay.
But published it in the Vietnam magazine.
Okay.
And it has a an extensive discussion of how who was there and at least during my time. Now there was a period when. When the Americans ran, were in charge of the Rungsat, and I'm trying to remember, the senior advisor at the time was a a Navy commander. Any case, his discussion of the what were in that area in terms of ships and boats and forces differs from mine considerably, because I was there after we decided to turn over and put the Vietnamese back in charge, and
right. So
I had a different set of equipments and fighting materials, et cetera, than previous senior advisors.
Right. But,
so that my discussion that I had published years ago differs somewhat from the recollection of some people who were there at a different time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Basically, we had intelligence arm that with PRU and the PSYOP people, Phoenix and all that down there.
Okay.
And we had RPDs and PBRs and RAG, MSBs, MSRs and PBRs, and what am I saying? I had SEALs come in as needed,
mm-hmm.
And we had choppers, Hueys. As it turns out, we had already turned over those helicopters to the Vietnamese, and the pilots were basically first and second lieutenant Army pilots,
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese. Young kids, who were really, really young, right out of aviation school.
Okay.
And we also had besides the PRUs, the Provincial Reconnaissance Units, we had regional force and popular force people.
Right.
And self defense, and we had whatever we could call in, we could call in support from other places, from up in Tonsonhut and Cameron. Cameron was pretty far away, but we had American aviation available.
Right.
And all those airplanes that we could call on us, and that sort of thing. So anyway, it was an active area, and in my tour there, we had some attacks in the village areas, which we pursued. We did some. We went into the run set itself is about 500 square miles. Maybe I said that 500 square mile area.
Right.
Surrounding Long Tao,
mm-hmm.
and it was absolutely the ugliest piece of property I ever saw, maybe will ever see.
Right? Could you elaborate on that a little bit about the environment?
Oh gosh, yeah. It was if you were to look down on the from the sky on the rung set, it would look like it had a feel to it, looked like a human brain.
Okay.
Thousands of squiggly, wormy looking rivers, and was mostly out of water.
Okay.
Covered with water, rather. Lots of water and some dry areas from time to time, all mud, the only way you could get around in the rung set was by boat,
mm-hmm.
or chopper if you happen to own them. We owned the only choppers for And there were other large rivers paralleling in some cases, but none of them were as deeply channeled as we made the Long Tile Channel.
Right.
And morning. I just said good morning, my wife.
Okay.
So let's see. Matter of fact, I can remember standing on the tarmac down there and looking out at that terrain and saying to myself, you know, someday I'm going to write a book about this this ugly thing.
Right.
And I did.
Right.
but I spent once they gave me gave me the whole organization. As a senior advisor, I was advisor to two Vietnamese, a captain and then a commander.
Right.
Then we began reducing the Americans over the next year from a force of probably a couple hundred. I don't remember the exact number when I first went there. Couple hundred advisors, reduced it down to a year later in February, we turned it over in January or February of 73,
okay.
February 73, and we drove out of there, turned it all over to the Vietnamese.
Right.
And drove on up to Saigon, went into barracks up there for a week maybe, and then we caught a plane, and all the advisors, Marines didn't go with us, actually all the sailors. The Marines kept their guys in country. We flew out on we had 24, we were down to 24 advisors when we left Rung Sat.
Okay.
And we turned it over. They had a little ceremony for us when we left, and we had trucks and jeeps, and we mounted up and drove out and went up to Saigon and then caught a plane back to the States. And it turned out that when our plane took off, for history's purposes, when we took off, the North Vietnamese released the first plane to back to with the POWs.
Oh wow! Okay.
And that was the deal. We were to when the Americans began to leave, then they would start letting the POWs go.
Right. Right.
I can imagine what the POWs felt like when they got on the plane and flew out of there. You know,
sure.
They probably were a shade happier than we were, but not much. Mm. Our guys were stomping their feet and saying, you know, happy as hell to go home.
Right.
Anyway, my my duties as a senior advisor were to meet with my counterparts on a daily basis, go over the situation in Rung Sat and go over the logistics numbers and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would almost always jump the reconnaissance chopper and fly the Long Tile.
Right.
And then I would go with my advisors my counterparts on an operation or a meeting that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I always had a translator with me, usually a sergeant, Vietnamese sergeant, and whenever I went to meetings, they would translate for me.
Right.
And then I would go on specific operations. We made amphibious ops into various parts of the Rung Sat. or we thought the enemy were hiding or trying to build up forces and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I occasionally, I don't remember that I had any routine, take a ride in a PBR with sailors or get on a minesweep and take a drive down the Long Tao overnight, minesweeps.
Right.
And go with my Marines. I had a Marine Major, John Carty. Who was my? I made my exec of the operational side of the operational hat, and I made a lieutenant commander, supply corps officer, my exec of on the logistics side.
Right.
And I would meet with them, and we'd work on whatever was going on operationally, and I would go with the Marines from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was quite busy
sure.
during the remainder of my tour there. I guess I came home about a couple weeks or, short of the short of the 1 year mark.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there. We came home in February, and I had gone in March the year before. So.
Right. Okay.
That's basically what I did down there.
Okay.
And language, I used the language a few words.
Right.
Most of both of my counterparts spoke English very well.
Okay.
And I could listen and understand some of the language, but. The briefers, military briefers, tended to talk pretty fast.
Right.
And I couldn't keep up all that well, so I needed a translator. Mm-hmm. And I could catch a few words here and there.
Right.
And if they had charts they were talking to, I could follow the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And culturally, I was very impressed with the training they gave us. Back in the States,
yeah,
that prepared me to live with the Vietnamese. It's a field that continues to be important to me in what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as SEER training and that sort of thing, I just assured myself I was never going to get captured.
Right.
Never want to do that.
Sure.
I was lucky. I'm fortunate that nothing ever happened.
Sure.
I flew just short of 100 chopper missions in there. We were dinged at once or twice, the pilots told me, but it was never got hit.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did kill some guys down in there that were probably insurgents. They were not uniformed. Although we went up against North Vietnamese a unit. Down there, and after a little bit of we had an Arvin battalion, and we sent the Marines and the battalion in, and there was a fight. It wasn't long, and we didn't have to. Of course, we had helicopters, and we had. Boats that could go in and there.
Right.
And it was short. And when it was over, they gave me a flag that they captured.
Okay.
North Vietnamese flag.
Right.
Which I donated to the Texas Tech.
Okay.
I donated all my papers and a flag and all sorts of things to Texas Tech.
Okay.
Somewhere there, down there.
All right.
Yeah, let's see what else.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Sure.
What was your opinion of the South Vietnamese forces, your counterpart, and of the South Vietnamese forces there?
Well, that was that's an interesting one because there's there was always a discussion how by American forces that the Vietnamese were lazy or corrupt and that sort of thing. I remember that even before I left while I was still in the States, I remember people talking about that. I didn't discover any of that. I found, I do know that my Commander Nang was my counterpart on the logistics side, also owned a restaurant in Saigon.
Right.
And but I didn't see that he was corrupt in his naval work.
Right.
He had a set of quarters on Na Bay base. And he would occasionally bring his wife down there, but she didn't live there.
Mm-hmm.
He brought her down one time and had me for a supper that she prepared.
Right.
And I never could see that he was taking anything. The other guy, Captain. Give me a moment to remember his name.
Sure.
Hop, H-O-P.
Okay.
Ita Hop. He invited me to go with him to his quarters at where his wife lived, because he had quarters at the Na Bay base as well.
Mm-hmm.
He had his wife and children at the on the base at the shipyard in Saigon.
Right.
And I went up there and had supper in his quarters. His wife made the meal. And unlike most women, Vietnamese women, she did in fact eat with us.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they eat in the kitchen while the men eat separately, but she came and she actually knew some English.
Right.
She was educated.
Mm-hmm.
And my observation of Captain Hop was that he was assigned a set of quarters on the base there. He had several children. They were going to school at the base school, and they were learning English.
Mm-hmm.
They came to meet me. And we spoke some words that he encouraged his children to speak English to me.
Right.
And I did not detect anything untoward by either of those men.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, Hop was a tough leader. He felt strongly about protecting Long Tao.
Okay.
And religiously included me in all the briefings about operations in the Long Tao. And but I was a bullheaded guy. I would go to the meetings even if I wasn't invited.
Mm-hmm.
He caught a sailor, or his people caught a sailor from one of the RAG units, or doing said broke, you know, violated the rules, and they gave him a court martial.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was over, part of his punishment was to be put on display at the front gate of the Rungsat base, the Nabe base, on his knees. Now, I disagreed with Captain Hoppe about this, but he said, "Yeah, well, you take care of your soldiers and your Marines and sailors, and I'll take care of them my way."
Sure.
And he had this guy tied up, his feet and his arms behind him, and his feet and his arms, his hands tied to his feet on his knees. And had him sit out there on his knees on display for almost the entire day.
Wow.
As a warning to the rest of the men who were at the base at Nha Bay, the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a tough guy, and I talked about that as a very cruel punishment that we would not do in the American Navy. I talked to that to Comnav 4B, and I told him, and he said, "Well, this is our culture, and this is what we do, and this is how we keep them." Now, the Navy and the Marine Corps were I'm guessing, I guess I can say this is a little cut above the draftees that they had, were pretty proud warriors.
Right.
They were very proud, and they kept their ships squared away and did a pretty good job. I hope that's a long winded answer to your question.
No, that's very good.
Yeah.
Were there other incidences similar to this? Did this type of punishment thing, did this happen quite a bit? Was
well, when I observed this one, it was the first time I had observed them doing this. I did make it clear to Captain Hoppe that we didn't prove that.
Sure.
And I think he backed away. If he did it, it was certainly out of sight from me. I didn't see it again after that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
I'm not saying that he did it because I disapproved or whatever.
Right.
I just don't remember him
right.
doing it.
What types of things were the Vietnamese sailors doing to get into trouble and to be punished like this? Do you know?
Well, he held captain's mast, which is the equivalent of captain's mast that all the armed forces in the world hold. That's at the local command level,
right?
Short of court martials and whatever. And he had an exec, by the way, who was his exec was an army officer. And he was a Indian. He was from India.
Okay.
Well, he was a Vietnamese, but originally his family had come to Vietnam from India.
Okay.
He was a darker skinned man. He was slender, and he was a tough infantry kind of guy. And he did most of the stuff, the small stuff.
Okay.
If a soldier or a sailor weren't wearing their uniform properly, he took care of that sort of thing.
Right. Okay.
The only ones that went up to Captain Hoppe were the serious offenses, and I frankly probably are no different than the kind of things that our American sailors do today.
Right.
You know, somebody goes out and gets drunk and or beats up somebody or thievery, or if it gets to be a serious thing in the American Navy, we take it to court martial.
Mm-hmm.
So they did very much the same. They had the same essential rules that we did,
right?
And took care of it that way,
right? Okay. As far as the fighting ability of the South Vietnamese, were they pretty good?
Actually, yeah, I thought they would. What happened is my exec, John Carty, who was a Marine major at the time, he's retired colonel now, lives in Washington area.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw him 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact. John and his advisors stuck to the Vietnamese soldiers like super glue. I'll tell you, they set a high standard for the Vietnamese, and went on every operation with them. We had a battalion of Vietnamese army there, and it was commanded by a Vietnamese. This is a regular battalion.
Right.
And the battalion commander was a major, and he was a wiry, and he was very offensive and very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And and they were good soldiers. They and my Cardi and his advisors kept me informed on their training and how good they were and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They were very good. It was a good battalion.
Okay. Do you remember any particular incidences or encounters they had with the enemy that you could talk about?
It's really fairly vague in my my memory right now. I wish I had a map of the wrong set in front of me. I don't. I turned all that stuff over to Texas Tech.
Right.
My maps, my leg maps that I.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the way the shape the Rungsat was shaped is it shaped a little bit like a heart.
Okay.
If you follow me, it was fatter at the top and skinnier at the bottom, and the river ran through it. And
right.
And up in the northern part of the western part, because it's Vietnam runs north and south,
mm-hmm.
and the river ran basically east and west from the ocean, from the ocean to the east.
Okay.
In the Saigon. And up in the northern part of the Rungsat, there was a section where we were sure. We had Kong organized in there.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, the intelligence told us that we did. We even knew the name of the guerrilla leader.
Okay.
Who had been and I'm trying to reach back into my my memory of the papers that I had that I brought out and turned over to Texas Tech.
Right.
We even knew the name of the colonel. He was a North Vietnamese colonel who, according to our intelligence, had walked a whole year. Took him a whole year to walk from Hanoi down to the Delta.
Wow.
And he took command of the guerrillas down there, and he lived up in that area. I'm trying to remember the name of the area now. And we could never get him. We had operations go in, and we had Pru go in there for intel.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we had a battle up in that area.
Okay.
We sent a pretty good sized force into the area. We had intel that said that the guerrillas had set up a pretty good camp, And we went up and we took it. We found lots of stuff up in there, weapons and whatever. And there was they brought back bodies. I was in the command boat, but I was pretty distant from the fight. And we were manning the fight from the command boat.
Sure.
The enemies were, and they were radio signals and whatever. So they brought back bodies, and then and I'm trying to remember when that. I don't remember what time of year that. Time of the year that was. It was more likely, as I recall, it was more likely to fall when the dry season was coming on.
Right. Okay.
In the wet season, it would rain almost every day. Temperatures were 113, 115.
Wow.
You put on a uniform in the morning and. In half an hour to an hour, it was soaked, what else can I say? Yeah, your boots got heavy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right. You know, you just flashback here memories, and there were bugs and all its. Stuff that we had, and and then we had another excursion down in the western side. I'm sorry, the eastern side of the Rungsat, where near the mouth of the Longtow, there was a village down there, and we had a boat come in with that brought. Weapons in down there. We had, if you remember, we had what were the boats we used to run off the coastal craft?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't mine. They had another part of the organization.
Right.
117, I think.
Okay.
They got by whoever this boat got by them and was spotted and went down and our people fought them, captured the stuff, and those are two
okay.
isolated things. But there were things going on from time to time. No, during my tour there, no ship. No ship was hit on its transit to and from Saigon. I had one ship run aground during my tour, and there were ships that reported being shot at,
right?
But none were hit, and the one that ran aground, we were worried about it because it wasn't, you know, it was stationary and was. A big target, but we got down there. I called in the Navy tugs from Saigon, and it took about an hour and a half to 2 hours for them to get down there. And we got the ship off the mud.
Mm-hmm.
We had to wait till a high tide, and we had two tugs come alongside and pull it off the mud. And then, the ship got underway and went out up to Saigon, and my counterpart, Captain Hopp, and I, and a small force of soldiers that came on board to protect the ship, we all got off down rope ladders and into the boats, into some small boats, and the ship went on its way into Saigon.
Okay.
And that was the only river incident that I remember.
All right.
No ship was hit during that period. So, what else was I going to say? Tactics. They were the tactics used there were I suppose what the ambushes, and we did all the from time to time all those tactics that you would that were used in the riverine business.
Right.
So anyway.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the enemy and their capabilities?
Well, let's see. The enemy, we had, we were worried about the enemy using the Rungset terrain to move goods from the north to south, and the they had we thought that they had regular forces up in that area that I discussed a minute ago, up in the northern
right.
I guess it was in the western corner of the Rungset. It was a much drier area, and more and they we think they used that area to build tunnels and other places to live, and in order to move goods through there. There were North Vietnamese forces in there. How many? I don't know.
Right.
We had reports, and I don't have any of the intel reports with me now.
Mm-hmm.
The reports we had North Vietnamese. We had mostly guerrillas and mostly young people.
Okay.
How well trained they were, probably no better than or worse than the terrorists we are experiencing over in the Middle East anymore. They come out of some school, and they give them a gun and take them, point it, shoot it, and give them some. And I didn't think the few times that we during my year there that we had combat. They were no match for the people we sent in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. What types of weapons were they using, do you know?
AK-47s.
Okay.
Anything they could steal.
Right.
They had B-40 rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, I wish I could... it turned out, toward the end of my tour, we had intelligence that they that the Rungset guerrillas had had acquired Russian rockets, wire-guided rockets.
Right.
And basically they used they attempted to mine the Long Tao,
mm-hmm.
and we kept minesweepers on. We swept the mines every day, swept the river rather for mines every day.
Right.
And they attempted to mine, they carried shoulder held weapons. They had no major weapons. They couldn't move them around in a Rungset. You couldn't move a howitzer, for instance, or you could move a mortar around. But you had to have boats, a substantial boat to move that stuff.
Right.
So they were mostly shoulder held small weapons.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me your thoughts on the Vietnamization process and how well you thought it was going. Did you at any time think that the South Vietnamese are, no matter what we do, they're going to lose the war? I mean, did you have those kind of thoughts? And could you tell me a little bit about the Vietnamization process?
Yeah. Actually, I felt that in my area, and I'm not, it had nothing to do with my capacity as a leader. I thought they were quite good.
Right.
I always thought that if you were to look at what we turned over to the men who we turned over, they were quite competent and would engage very well. And I never thought that they would lose the war. They had the same same desires, and most of them had the senior cop and Nang had been to America and had been trained in America, and they were strong. Now, I have to say this, that when I went in the country in 72, the politics were such that America was really upset about the Vietnamese War.
Right.
And they were marching back here in the States and yelling and screaming and whatever else. We didn't pay a great deal of attention to that, but because we had a mission to do. But the undertone was that the war was going to come to an end. And our job was to keep the Vietnamese motivated. But that the reality was that we were going to be leaving sometime.
Right.
And we began sending our soldiers and sailors and Marines home over the year. We went from a couple of hundred advisors down to, as I told you, the last group. Well, I left with 24 sailors and Marines in February of 73. And during that period, we were well aware that the war was that we were to turn over, and we did.
Mm-hmm.
We turned everything over basically during that year to the Vietnamese. We helped them with maintenance. We helped them. They didn't need a lot of help on tactic operational matters because they already had the forces, and they already were had command of the PBRs and the minesweeps and that sort of thing. So because the people started the Vietnamization a year or so before the year I was there, so it was well underway, and basically they were running everything during the time, and we made an effort, big effort, to make sure that they were well trained and they had they understood all the equipment we turned over to them, and they were quite good. And I thought that they would be able to protect the Long Tao,
right.
And do the work of the Rungset without any problems at all, no matter what happened.
Okay,
that was my feeling.
Right. Okay. And how did the South Vietnamese, how did they react to this Vietnamization process? Were they concerned about the Americans leaving, or how did they react?
No. We never talked about it. It was in terms of whether or not how they felt. It was essentially the late fall of 72. It was locked in concrete that America was going to go leave, and we talked about our leaving. We talked about the politics, and excuse me, I'm going to take a sip of coffee here.
Sure.
There was never, I don't remember ever discussing that. That they didn't want it to happen. We talked occasionally and about the politics of Vietnam, and they the my counterparts, my two counterparts, Captain Hopp, had been gone through the military academy in Hanoi. And he had been in his career, he had already been in the Navy, Vietnamese Navy, for about 25 years or more. And he had already been fighting for that period of time.
Right.
If it wasn't the North Vietnamese, it was guerrillas, or it was always something that they were involved in fighting.
Sure.
And, so it wasn't anything new to them. They knew how to fight in the Rungsat.
Right.
I don't think they ever felt like our leaving was going to change what they did.
Okay.
At all.
Okay.
And, I guess what our main thing was, at least from a CO's point of view, I talked to my troopers, my Marines and sailors, and I, you know, keep up, you've got to keep doing your job right to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And my Americans did. I had no problem my entire year with the American Marines and sailors that I had as advisors. They were the best guys I think I've ever served with. There were, first of all, they were all petty officers.
Mm-hmm.
And the lowest Marines, I think, were sergeants that were in the went out in the villages.
Okay.
And we had very competent personnel. They were, and they never caused me. I never had to hold a captain's mask one time for any of my guys.
So there were no misgivings about participating in the war, and you know that America's about to leave and go home. There was no issues with that or anything.
On the Vietnamese part?
Well, no, I mean on the American part.
On the American part? Not at all.
Okay.
These were all volunteers,
mm-hmm.
and they'd come over to serve, and, you know, you would hear, you know, a little buzz in the bar occasionally, but they were solidly about doing their job right to the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you: do you know what happened to Captain Hopp and the other?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, and I've never getting contact through the grapevine. I have had contact with Vietnamese military guys over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Hopp retired, and he was taken into put in jail.
Right.
And spent 4 or 5 years in what I guess they call re-education, and then at some point he got out of Vietnam and he was up in the Chicago area.
Okay.
And Commander Nang also got out and came to America, and I want to think he was in the Southwest, and I have never put out word to Vietnamese military organizations here in the States. You know, when they came here, they kept their affiliations. If they were in the Army, they did just like we do. We had, Vietnam Veterans of America and all those different organizations in America. They also have organizations of Vietnamese veterans. And I'd let people know that I was interested in making contact with Captain Hopp and Commander Nang, but never was able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard from them, never knew exactly where they were, never got a phone number or anything, but they did get back to the States.
Okay. All right.
I had one incident where I got a call from a Congressman, I think his name is Bo, 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 Bomert, okay, out of New York. And he asked me if I remembered Sergeant On something, I can't remember, On. Mm-hmm. And he said he has been, he is in Vietnam. He's applied to come to the States, and he's coming up, wants to come up to a family in New York, and he wants to know if you remember him. That he needs to, verification that he was a good guy.
Right.
And so I wrote a letter to the congressman and said, I remember him very well. He was my interpreter. And he certainly deserves to come be, come back to get, come to the United States. And never heard any more about it to my my guess that it happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What about the units that these guys were commanding? Do you know what happened with them? Did they, I mean, I'm assuming that they fought all the way to the end until the last day, but do you know anything about what happened with them?
Well, I'll tell you, let me think. moving ahead, after I left Vietnam, I was given command of a brand new destroyer escort, mm-hmm, frigate.
Right.
Actually, it was USS Cook, and as it turns out, it was Cook was named after my Annapolis classmate, Wilmer Cook, who got shot down over North Vietnam.
Okay.
And so I deployed to back to, would you believe, back to the Vietnamese War, and for one full deployment, and then came then went home and then came back out, and I was relieved in 1975 before the final people left in 75.
Right.
And, but I've been briefed by guys who were on the ship that Cook was there in 75 when the Vietnamese North Vietnamese overran the country and they all came out. And I was been briefed by shipmates of mine on Cook who were there and I was not. Mm-hmm. That the Vietnamese Navy packed up every ship and boat they could, and then sailed out of down through the Long Tao and out through the Rungsat and Vung Tao, and went to sea and went over to the Philippines.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to remember what the original question was because I got sidelined.
Right. Just what had happened to those units?
Okay. Yeah. they abandoned everything that they didn't need.
Mm-hmm.
The Rungs, the Nabe base, they everybody got went out on their own. People, the officers all got on board the big ships and went to sea. Sailors needed went to sea, and as many people as they could with families were put to sea. And Nabe was turned over, not turned over, rather, was abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And where I was going with that is years later, in 2000, I went back to Vietnam and
okay.
went to Nabe. And one of my, I tried to get aboard the base. It was turned over to the Vietnamese Navy now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no north and south anymore. There's just the Vietnamese Navy.
Right.
And the Nabe base still exists. The buildings, the American buildings are still exist. They wouldn't let me aboard because I had, they told me I had to have permission from Hanoi to go aboard. But they were, you know, they sent an officer, the officer they out to talk to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that base was turned over to the Vietnamese Navy, and it still exists and it still has functioning capabilities.
Okay.
There, it's a ship repair facility, et cetera.
All right.
Let's see. Then, excuse me, to verify that, one of my corpsman who was with me in the Rungsat Special Zone just last year went back to Vietnam, and he went to Nha Ve. He speaks fluent Vietnamese, mm-hmm. and he somehow conned his way to get aboard the base.
Wow.
And he, because he was such a smooth talker, I guess, and he toured the base, and it was. He said it looked very much like it had been when we were there.
Right. Okay.
So we built some pretty good buildings, anyway.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So you, when did you receive your orders to pull out? What that last pull? Was it February 73?
Yeah. Well, it was probably it took us a month to. Turn over everything, as
okay.
I recall. It was probably came in January. I don't remember when they announced it. If I remember correctly, Nixon was president and had set up a program that we would pull out in a phased way, and we were in pretty good shape in the Rungsat, and we matched up pretty well with the POW handshake up there, and that we were one of the first to leave, thus
right.
permitting the POWs to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to have about a month, as I recall, sometime in January, that we got the word that we'd be pulling out, and as soon as we could turn over, so we turned over all the boats and all the barracks and all whatever equipment we had, and got a couple of big trucks and jeeps and whatever, and loaded them up, and then drove up to Saigon, stayed in I forget what they called that hotel up there, Annapolis Hotel.
Right. Yeah.
And then we all went as a group over to the air base there.
Mm-hmm.
Tatsunut, and got aboard a big old ship, big old airplane, and flew away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What were the, do you remember the conversations and just the attitude leaving?
Oh, they were giddy.
Sure.
Well, first of all, they came aboard the airplane, half of them were drunk.
Mm-hmm.
they were capable of carrying their bag, but that was about it.
Right.
And they were happy guys, and I remember the hooting and hollering, and when we taxied out, and I remember the guys saying, "How do I get out of this fucking place? I'm finally out." And
right.
use that war language, but
sure.
I don't know, you know, take me back to freedom, I didn't leave anything behind, and all sorts of things like that.
Right, sure.
They were stomping their feet, and when that plane lifted off, and those wheels pounded into the bottom of that plane,
mm-hmm.
you know how that goes. They were just the happiest guys in the world. I'll tell
right.
you, they
sure.
were. They were up. We were on a civilian airplane,
mm-hmm.
and had. Sturdy on board, and they were trying to keep these guys in their seats, and they were up dancing around, stomping their feet.
Sure.
Yeah, high-fiving and, you know, whatever else, and hugging their buddies and saying, hey, boy, my God, it was a real show.
Sure, I bet it was.
Real show.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
Well, where did...
I have to say that when we landed back in... Northern California,
mm-hmm.
if I recall, and then we split up, and we said to send our goodbyes, and went on back to our homes. I did not experience any spitting or bad stuff. Personally, I didn't remember it, although the newspapers and of the day talked about the behavior of Americans related to the kids coming back, but
right.
I didn't experience any of that.
Okay. So then would you say your reception back was pretty good then?
Well, we my wife was in Southern California, San Diego, with my children,
mm-hmm.
and I had to make my way back down here. And so we all, I'm trying to remember how I got down here. I think I walked across the tarmac and got a Navy plane or I can remember. I don't remember.
That's all right. That's fine.
I only know I got home.
Right. And did you have some time off? I would assume you did before your next assignment to the Corps.
Well, not very much. I was home for a leave for I think a better part of a month. But I had received orders to the USS Cook, and it was home ported in Long Beach, California, and I went up and took command in Long Beach,
mm-hmm.
and my family was there, of course, and my wife wasn't too keen on that because
sure.
I had been on First Fleet staff. That was a sea job. Although we didn't deploy to the Western Pacific, we deployed to the Middle of the Pacific on that staff. And then I went in country for a year, or almost a year, and had all that training stuff I was doing before that.
Right.
And then I came out, and they gave me a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the reason I was sent over to Vietnam was that the jobs that I was sent to in Nha Ve and Logistics Base and Rungsat was that they had to have, to be the senior advisor there, you had to have a screen for command.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I had already screened when I was, I had screened for destroyer command back in when I was at the War College, when I was promoted to commander, I had already screened to be a captain of a destroyer, but they had to have me. They needed somebody who would pre-screen in Vietnam, so I went over and did that job.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back out, I was very much anxious to take command of a ship because I had been yearning to be a destroyer skipper for about 4 years.
Sure.
And they said that you could go to shore duty, or we'll give you a ship.
Mm-hmm.
Notwithstanding arguments from my wife, who is a wonderful trooper, I was given command of a new ship, and I was jumped at it.
Sure.
We almost moved up to Long Beach, but it turned out in 74, they changed the home port to San Diego,
okay.
and we were able to stay in San Diego. Then wasn't too long after that that I deployed the ship back over to the Western Pacific for 7 months.
Right.
So I was spending a lot of time in the Western Pacific.
Mm-hmm, sure. Yep. You mentioned in your veterans questionnaire, talk about your duties in the demining, participation in the demining of Haiphong Harbor. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, I'd forgotten. I filled out a form like that. I don't remember doing that. But in any case, I wonder why you knew some of the questions to ask me. That was the first, my first deployment with Cook. I had a helicopter on board, we went back over to, as a matter of fact, the helicopter ship was taking a helicopter on a ship for a deployment was new. We had used helicopters on the ships in and around the States,
mm-hmm.
but Cook and its helicopter was the first to make a full deployment to the Western Pacific.
Okay.
And so I was, when we got over, I forget exactly when, we were sent up into the Tonkin Gulf as a protection for the minesweeping craft and minesweeping helicopters that we had up there on amphibious ships. And while we demined that Haiphong Harbor, Cook was shotgunned for, and a few other destroyers were shotgunned for the amphibious ships that carried the demining helicopters and demining and minesweepers that we had up there, small minesweepers. And it was pretty interesting. We had a hurricane or typhoon came through one time. We had to pull out of there, and I remember the ship had some damage to a forward gun mount as a result of the weather. But other than that, it was interesting to be up in that area into the Tonkin Gulf without anybody shooting at you.
Sure.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. What were your thoughts on this duty about demining the harbor? Did you have any thoughts about why are we doing this or anything?
Well, truthfully, I always thought that America had invested so much into Vietnam that we should have come away, we should not have lost the war. I always felt that.
Right.
And that I had strong feelings about what we should have done to win the war, and that would have been seal off North Vietnam and bomb their dikes and flood the bastards and whatever we needed to do to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
That was just my personal feelings.
Sure.
And so when we the harbor up there was just one of the things that I thought we should do.
Right.
So when it was all over and you pull them out, I mean, there's at least you know that we did some of the things that we should have done.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we should have done even more.
Okay. All right.
But that's just an old sailor talking.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, how close to the coast did you actually get? I mean, could you see Haiphong fairly closely, or I mean, how close?
Pretty vague right now. I think we knew where we were. We had the charts. We were right nearby the mouth of the Haiphong. I can't remember how much I saw.
Right.
I was. Had my nose down on navigation, making sure we didn't run aground, and we stayed in the formations and that sort of thing.
Sure.
That was about it.
Okay. How long were you there in the Haiphong area?
I don't remember that either. It was days.
Okay.
It was days. I don't know that it was, I don't know that how much, it, how, whether it was weeks or not, I don't know.
Okay.
It was, We were there a pretty good piece of time because it took you had a and I don't know that much about minesweeping. You had these some of them were bottom mines and some were, and you had to go in and cut the wires and pop them to the surface and whatever the mine force does to shut them down.
Right.
And then you have to get them aboard and carry them away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grueling job and very dangerous.
Sure.
I don't remember any explosions or anything. Whatever they did it pretty safely, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I never got any reports that there were mines exploded, that sort of thing.
Okay. All right. And Outside of this duty at Haiphong, what other types of things was the cook doing while you were the captain of the ship?
Well, we did, of course, 7th Fleet is involved in show the flag,
mm-hmm.
Training with our allies. We went into South Vietnam and did an operation with South Korea.
Okay.
The South Korean Navy. We went. We used our helicopter, which is basically an anti-submarine chopper.
Mm-hmm.
We used it in an operation with the South Koreans.
Okay.
We went into Japan and did a major flag commander cruiser destroyer 3 came aboard my ship, and during a major exercise with the Japanese Navy, and we were launching torpedoes and not armed, and flying missions with the Japanese Navy during that ASW operation. And what else we were doing? We did show the flag port visits and the typical things that that peacetime Navy does.
Okay.
As the war was over, and
right.
For us, the Americans had come out in 73.
Mm-hmm.
We were among the first to come out, but eventually the entire military got out in 73.
Mm-hmm.
And by 74, we were back to peacetime operations.
Right. Okay. And
I redeployed, went home, and then prepared the ship for redeployment. We came back out in 75, and I was relieved in April of 75, and flew back to San Diego. The ship, in turn, went to off of off of South Vietnam, and were there, if you recall, when the last Americans came out.
Right.
Okay. 75 April. Right. I call it Black April now. You know, mm-hmm. That's a nickname.
Right.
By everybody, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how closely did you follow the fall of Saigon and the end of the war?
I followed it very closely. I have to say that when I said I was going to write a book about the Rungsat, after I retired from the Navy, I set about to do that, and I knew a lot about what was happening in Vietnam. I followed it to the extent that we were able to know in the newspapers and television through the 70s, and
mm-hmm.
To the extent that I could, I followed the war. From 75, from 73 on.
Right.
And I knew pretty much what was going on.
Okay. How did you feel? Did you have any particular emotions or feelings the day that you heard that Saigon fell?
Yeah, I did. I said very strong feelings. I just felt we shouldn't have lost the war.
Right.
And I just, from a military point of view, not necessarily, excuse me, not necessarily from a citizen's point of view, probably citizens see it a different way, but we military guys have to career military, and I felt we should have won the war,
right.
And we should have funded it, whatever they needed. I didn't, so I was felt very strongly about the overrunning Saigon and north taking over the south and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I was also influenced by my counterparts who hated the North Vietnamese, even though Dai Tha Hap had been a graduate of the military academy North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
When he came, he was a South Vietnamese man, and so was Commander Dang. And it was clear to me that they talked to me about that there were two countries. There was a North Vietnamese, there were the North, and there were the South. And they hated the North.
Mm-hmm.
They called them dog eaters,
mm-hmm.
And they felt they were just they did not like the North. It was almost like. So I was infected by their comments,
right.
Such that when the South was overtaken, I felt very badly for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. After, I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, I guess, but after you left the Cook. Could you pick up on the story, your career from that point?
Yeah, well, I was Vice Admiral Bob Salzer, who had been one of my bosses in Vietnam, called me in, or had his aide called me and asked me if I wanted to go to work for him at the Naval Surface Warfare organization, new organization they were forming in San Diego. And he wanted an experienced destroyer captain to come into the logistics side of his operation and manage fleet maintenance. And so I couldn't say no. So I went there and I became the director of operational maintenance for the destroyer force, the mine force, the amphibious force. The logistics force, all the ships, there were about 100 or so ships in the Pacific.
Okay.
And I was director of maintenance for the ships, not when they were in overhaul, major overhaul, which was usually a 3 to 4 month period, but in between deployments and when they were deployed, when they were operational, all their maintenance was under my hat.
Okay.
And so it was an interesting 2 years that I served there. We had to bring all these, they had been separate organizations, and then we brought them all under one command as a Surface Force Pacific. And when I started, I had no money practically. Some of the types of ships had lots of money, some had none, so I had to design a funding program, and I went from a budget of something like, as many, 40 million bucks, hardly anything, up to hundreds of millions of dollars in a program that I developed maintaining the ships during their operational cycle. Now that was interesting, and then while I was there, I got promoted to captain, and very shortly after that, they sent me to Commander Cruiser Destroyer 1 as Chief of Staff for Operations and Plans.
Okay.
And I did that for about a year and a half, and we deployed again back out to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I got emergency orders to take command of the cruiser USS Warden,
okay.
PG-18, and he was in the Pacific, home ported in Yokosuka, and the emergency was that the captain's wife was diagnosed with cancer, and he had to leave the ship.
Okay.
So I was asked to go out and do that, and so I had guided me some cruiser, which was frosting on the cake for the for this old sailor.
Right.
I had it for almost 3 years.
Okay.
Home port in Yokosuka, Japan. But I was seldom there.
Mm-hmm.
Seldom there, and I was operating about 75% of the time I was underway, and had my wife and my youngest daughter with us, then after that job, I retired from the Navy. We had enough.
Okay. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about the Warden. You had mentioned yesterday in our conversation that wasn't on the interview about coming across some Vietnamese boat people. Could you tell?
Yeah. We did. We did a lot of that. I don't know. Maybe it was my closeness to the Vietnamese people that I developed when I was in country. But my leaning was that if we came across Vietnamese boat people, refugees at sea, we would pick them up. And so in the course of my plying the waters of between the Philippines and Vietnam and Thailand and those places, I ran across the Vietnamese in these small boats. I would tended to pick them up, and over, I suppose we brought aboard more than over several months, over 150 Vietnamese refugees. The last group was the most significant one in terms of my life connection to Vietnam and the Vietnamese people. Is we were heading, as I said, we were at orders to go to Indian Ocean, and I was the warden was to relieve a cruiser out there and become the commander of anti-air warfare for two carriers that were pre-positioned there to attack Iran because they had taken our embassy personnel as hostage.
Right.
So on the way there, I had to go through the South China Sea waters, and I had a P-3 come flying by, and the skipper of the airplane called me and said, on your track, there's a boat with some people on it, and you may want to take a look at it. So we did. We went over, and we found that we were in a hurry, but we slowed down to investigate the boat, and I sent an armed guard on a boat over, and my chief and the boat officer, the lieutenant, called me and said, "You won't believe this, skipper, but we've got a boat full of children."
Hmm.
And so we searched the boat and took any weapons away from them and brought it alongside, and we discovered they had been in the storm the night before, and all their food had been washed and wet and washed overboard, and their engine failed, and they didn't know where the hell they were, and they had been at sea for some period of time, and they were almost there were little babies on board.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a mother and a father. They were like 19, 20 years old or something, and they had some babies with them, and we had a lot of teenage kids, and I decided to bring them on board, and they came on board, and they then I had them tow the boat out, and I had my gunners shoot at it to sink it, and for whatever reason, they must have built the boat to never die. Gunners couldn't make it. They hit it, but it wouldn't get out. So I pulled back off and had my boat guys go over with some charges, and we sank the boat with some explosives, and it would have been a derelict sea, and I couldn't take it with me. So
right.
And we went on to Saigon, and my just as a little sideline, my sailors, as they always are, great people, and they took these kids and they got them showered and cleaned, and medics examined them, and they gave them a chaplain prayed over them and did all this stuff, and they fed them, and then they gave them all sorts of warden T-shirts and ball caps, and made them, took the kids under their arms and, and helped them. And we went on to Singapore, where we took them ashore.
Okay.
And turned them over to organizations that take care of refugees and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And we went on into the Indian Ocean and carried out our mission. And I might say that 15 years later, I got a telephone call, and one of the guys had he was in Moline, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and he had a restaurant, a Vietnamese restaurant, and he had a retired naval officer come in as one of his regular customers, and he asked this guy, how can I get a hold of the skipper of the USS Warden? And he told him, like, call Pentagon and they'll help you find him. So this guy did that, and he found me. And I connected with those 44 children and had a marvelous connection. It goes on today. We were we then got a telephone call and a letter from a lady in San Jose, California, told me that she was going to marry one of the boys that helped build the boat.
Mm-hmm.
They had built this boat themselves, by the way.
Oh, wow.
A couple of teenagers, 19, 20, and a year old guys, and they she was going to marry him, and she wanted me to come to the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted me to come. She wanted me to be her surprise wedding present to her husband. So, my wife and I went up, and we went to the church and watched them get married, and then we went to the reception, and they squirreled us around into a table without little notice as possible, and the place was full of Vietnamese people, and at the appropriate time, this young lady got up and took the microphone, and, oh, hey, I'm still on, okay, bye-bye. Was that time? Wow. Wait a minute. Hold on a minute. Wait.
Sure.
I thought you weren't going to 1:15. Yes, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I have down. 1:15. You better check it. Yeah. That was my wife. She has a medical appointment.
Okay.
Anyway, this Vietnamese American lady who had just been married to one of the guys on the boat, and she was not on the boat. She mm-hmm. she had come over earlier from some other means.
Okay.
And she introduced. She said, "Would Dr. Nelson come forward?" And so nobody knew who Dr. Nelson was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got up there. My wife and I got up there on the platform, and she said, "You probably don't recognize him as Dr. Carl Nelson, but you would recognize him as Captain Carl Nelson, the former commanding officer of USS Warden." And all those people were all there, and it was amazing. It was, the place went crazy.
Right.
And then they asked me to make a speech. I couldn't do it. I said, I fumbled some words out, but and her husband came over and hugged me. And the brothers, a couple brothers came, and then a lot of other people came. And then they, by now, 15 years or so, they had those who, they were older, and they, some of them married and they have children, and they brought their babies over, and I kissed a lot of babies at night. And it's marvelous, and we've stayed connected for all those years now.
Right.
So anyway, where are we? After Warden, I retired and wanted to keep busy, so I went back to school and earned a doctorate and became a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to write, so I began to writing. I wrote the book about Vietnam.
Right.
And I published eight nonfiction books in my my field, which is international economics and trade, and one of which is a bestseller on in America for its purpose, Import Export, How to Get Started in International Trade.
Okay.
Four editions and untold numbers of printings of the book.
Okay.
And it's coming out in a fourth edition this year, or next year, actually. And then I've written and have published three novels, one of which just came out in 1st of May. It's been out 4 months now. And I've had a life has been good except for one terrible thing. I lost my wife Barbara to lung cancer in 74, and that's changing my life
sure.
a great deal. But I was fortunate enough to meet a lady and have remarried subsequently, and life has been going on okay.
All right. Before wrapping the interview up, if you have a few more moments, I have some broad questions about your opinions on the war and your service, and you can say as much or as little as you want about these.
Okay.
One of the things I thought of, and I just thought of this one as, you know, as you were talking about your career, your long career in the Navy, but what would you say was the moment you were most proud of in your career with the Navy, or is there some? Is there one
proud.
That comes?
Saving the lives of the refugees.
Okay.
I mean, all the other work was about war.
Sure.
And this was about saving lives as opposed to killing people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And we've touched on this again, so you don't have we've touched on this before, so you don't have to say too much about this. You don't just your opinion of American policy towards Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Looking back on it now, has your opinion changed over time? Or
I have to go on, but what I think we knew. And at the time, we had gone through a period of time when the Cold War had started, okay? And we were we had a passion. We were passionately against communism.
Mm-hmm.
And we were afraid because our free enterprise capitalistic, socio-capitalistic system was working for us, and it was not working for other countries at the time, and who then turned to a heavy socialistic government. So we were afraid, and based on that, we were worried about the expansion of communism and highly social organizations eroding the success that we had experienced in America.
Mm-hmm.
So when we diagnosed the government people. Eisenhower and beyond began looking at the global strategy. They saw the possibility of very poor countries, including Vietnam, adopting communism, it was a real fear by our leaders. And based on that, our movement to help the South Vietnamese fend off communist North was valid, I think, based on what we knew, as best I can determine. It was valid.
Okay.
It turned out that if they were looking at Asia right now, they would realize that communism not only didn't work, the capitalism and free enterprise has gripped Asia, and they're doing it better than we are.
Right.
They love capitalism.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I'm worried that this phone that I have may have lost its charge. I'm
okay.
Not sure. So I switched phones.
Okay. All right.
I would say that based on the strategies of the time, we did the right thing to go there. In retrospect, and based on the information at the time, I would say that we prematurely left, and that we should have worked harder to save Vietnam. Although I understood the strategists' fears of going into war with a country as big as China.
Sure.
We don't want to do that, I don't think. I mean, they have three times the population of America, maybe more than three times.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel that we could have sealed off some part of North Vietnam. And but in any case, they're very, very, very well qualified people who have written about how we could have won the war.
Right.
I certainly was not at that level at any time in my career in terms of understanding what we could have done and what the strategy of saving Vietnam might have been. But I've read some stuff since then, and there are some good books that tell us that we could have won.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we had.
Okay. All right. What's your opinion about U.S. Vietnamese relations today and just the reconnecting to Vietnam today? What do you think about that?
Well, I went back and I talked to my my kids who go back often.
Mm-hmm.
I have my kids have brought their kin from Vietnam to California. One of my kids brought his mom and dad over, and I went back and I lived with the parents in 2000. I was asked by one of my Vietnamese kids, his name is Luong Nguyen, his American name is Lu. He asked me if I would go back to Vietnam with him and meet his parents. And so I did, and another pal of mine, a retired Army colonel, went back with me. And we went up to Bang Mai Thuot and stayed at the home of this parents of one of these guys. So I was able to observe, and of course, my doctorate, and I became a professor of international business, and so because of that, I was very interested in of observing Vietnam as it is today.
Sure.
I had, as a matter of fact, interesting, when I had been at Monterey, I had done an extensive thesis on the issue was what would you have to do to increase the per capita income of Vietnam from, at the time, it was like $50 a year to up to get them to have a per capita income of maybe $500 a year, and I came up with a macro plan to do that. And then going back in 2000, I was able to observe, and I frankly saw, I felt the North Vietnamese are working hard to stay in a heavy socialistic environment, just as China is. They're trying to have an underlying socialistic organization, national organization. At the same time, they're doing free enterprise. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered was that Vietnam was buzzing with lots of work. Mm-hmm. Much of it was financed through the World Bank and the IMF for projects that would improve Vietnam. And I did see the electrification of Vietnam happening, probably as a result of American dollars going to the IMF or World Bank, et cetera.
Right.
I saw plants in manufacturing plants in and around Saigon, and I'm told they're in the north as well, taking advantage of the low wage rates to manufacture products for other countries, including Taiwan and Australia and Germany and France and whatever. And high employment. Everybody seemed to have a job. It was it was like an anthill. People were running around on their little old motorcycles and whatever. And the struggle is now there is because of the government of Vietnam is highly. Highly structured and highly controlling.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of under the table business that takes place. Vietnam relies a great deal on the American people who to come there and spend their money. I'm talking about the American Vietnamese,
right?
That used to be who fled and now go back. Routinely, they bring American dollars back, and they are slowly but surely buying up businesses and investing in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my kids are investing in they're building rental properties and all sorts of things in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and making and getting rich. But I know that when I drove when I took a Jeep ride from Saigon down to the Rung Sat and Na Bay, the terrain had changed immensely. The new homes, everybody had a house.
Right.
And you know, it depends on your outlook. They were not little shacks like they used to be when I was there.
Right.
These are solid places. And what happened was, of course, the North Vietnamese took back all the land,
mm-hmm.
and then redistributed it.
Right.
And gave everybody a piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
And then they built homes on them, and they built good homes. So to the extent that I was able, as a data point of one, an observer, I thought that life for the peasants had improved.
Mm-hmm.
They had a house, they had a piece of property, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not feel, in Saigon, I did not feel in danger at any time.
Okay.
I didn't see many police, although they said that there were some around. I hardly saw very many at all. And I did see lots of manufacturing going on, and they had some really good roads. The road from Saigon to Bang Mi Thuot,
mm-hmm.
was a superhighway.
Oh, wow.
So things were at least in 2000. Now it's eight years later. I assume that they've even made more progress. But
right.
That was my observation as a professor of international business. They're making gains.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, before wrapping the interview up, is there any last thing you'd like to say about your experiences or about Vietnam before we bring the interview to a close?
Gosh, it was a long road for me. Beginning in 63, and finally ending in 75.
Mm-hmm.
But I was involved in that war,
right,
to one way or another, one extent or another.
Mm-hmm.
I still have, as a result of that long experience. It was a war. It was my war during my time in the service. Everybody, the boys that were in during the 50s had Korea, and the boys that were in the 40s had the World War,
right,
Europe. And but my war was Vietnam, and I feel strongly about it, and I still follow closely. I wish, from a human point of view, I wish the Vietnamese people well.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Vietnamese people. I found them, the ones that I knew closely. I got close to them. It was built on friendship, and I hope that the people of the country survive, and their country grows, and they to a certain extent. If that were to happen, and the country not be overly socialistic, but accommodates free enterprise, I would say we in a certain way to look at it, we certainly won.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We were winners.
Yeah.
If in fact they grow economically through free enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. All right. Well, I'll go ahead and bring the interview to a close, but if you don't mind, I'd like to talk to you for a few more minutes after I stop it.
That'll be fine.
Okay.